everybody. Welcome to Spark. My name is Kyle, if we haven't met. I lead something called our national team at Crossroads. That's a team of folks who wake up every day and work hard to connect you to God and get the most out of Crossroads. Well, this is year three of Spark. And if you don't know what Spark is, I've got two examples for you. Okay, so first, if you're under 40, this is your example. I want you to imagine that TED Talks and Crossroads connected on Tinder. They swiped right. They went out for dinner. It was a great conversation, a couple drinks. And then they dated for an appropriate amount of time. They got engaged. What did you think I was going to say? They got engaged. They got married. And then they had a baby. And the baby's name is Spark. It's like TED Talks, but it's way more dangerous, fun, and it's actually useful and helpful for your life. That's what it's like. Okay. If you're over 40, I know this about you. You love a good sale, don't you? Like a good sale. And you're happy about 15% off. That's pretty good. But you get more excited about 25. If you see 50% off, you get really excited. But that's not the king of sales. The king of sales has four letters. B-O-G-O. Buy one, get one. Buy one, get one. Well, Spark is better than buy one and get one. Spark is buy none because it's free. Get three. Every week you get three talks instead of one. You know how you come to church sometimes and someone walks on stage and like you either connect or you don't. You get one swing at it. Spark, you get three swings at it. Three different speakers every weekend to help connect you, inspire you, and push you closer to God. That's what we're doing in this series. Now, most weekends don't have a theme, but this one does. And I don't have to know you to know this theme affects you directly, either you personally or somebody who's one arm length away, maybe a close friend, a neighbor, a family member. Today we're talking about mental health, and specifically we're digging into depression. To see, what does God have to say about this thing? Now for me, depression entered my life squarely in one day. It was April 14th, 2008, a day I'll never forget. My father-in-law struggled with depression, and he went missing that day. And I called my mother-in-law over and over. She didn't answer. And finally, someone did pick up the phone at her house, but it wasn't her. It was a police officer who said, "We found him. And unfortunately, he is dead. He's died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound." And in the 10 years since then, my wife and I have been wrestling with, what is this thing called depression? What is it, and where does it come from, and what does God have to say about it? And I'll just tell you, from a decade of searching, the world has no answers for you. It has none. Google depression, you'll see stats on the rise in a bad way. But I want you to know today is a difficult day. You're going to hear some difficult stories. But today is also a hopeful day. It is a hopeful day because I'm telling you, there is an answer. There is one answer, and his name is Jesus. And what I hope for you today is that maybe you walk in here and you think Jesus is as real as a unicorn. That's okay. I'm glad you're here. If that's your starting spot, I still hope at the end of this, you walk out saying, "Jesus, I need you. I need you, and I want you." And I hope you throw your life to him. Now, we're going to start out hearing from our senior pastor, Brian Tome, who sat down and interviewed a therapist in our community, a counselor named Mark Pruden. Mark's actually who helped my wife and I, Sarah and I, in the moments after our tragedy. And he's helped a lot of people around here. He's incredibly wise, and it is a privilege to get to hear from him. So let's hear from Brian and Mark now.
Depression is a major challenge for a lot of people. As a pastor who's been interacting with people very intensely for the last 20-some years, it always crushes me when I see how many people are getting crushed by being depressed, a mental state that keeps our head down and keeps us from having any sense of levity, any sense of focus, any sense of joy in life. It's real, and it seems to only be increasing. With me today is Mark Pruden. He's a counselor that I've worked with before personally. I referred a bunch of people to him. I guess my first question is, it seems like depression is only on the increase in our society. It's ending with, we've had some significant suicides in our culture recently. Why do you think depression is going up? So you think it is?
Alienation, loneliness. When our basic Human needs are more likely to be met: food, shelter, clothing. The needs you were talking about in the marriage presentation recently, the needs for significance, for security, those emerge even more strongly. Those are some of the things that are going to play into things like depression.
It is true that while I love the web, I love technology, I love how it's easy to find information, it really does pull us away. Technology has pulled us away. I love the fact that we have automatic washing machines, but you know, it used to be back in the day, you'd go down to the side of the creek and you'd pound your clothes with rocks with other people in the community. Yeah. I need to lay tile in a shower. I can go on YouTube right now and figure out how to do it versus I know a buddy or some guy who used to do it and I bring him over. We end up spending 2 days together and we lose that human connection. So do you think that our culture's lack of real touch is a significant thing
with
depression?
Absolutely.
So if someone is depressed, is there a three-step formula or what should we do?
Let's look first of all at where this comes from. Something has either gotten or is going to get all of us. You and I are not predisposed maybe to depression. You and I each have very significant spine issues. I mean, we deal with that stuff a lot. You've talked about that from
the stage. Right now.
Likewise. And we have to manage that continuously. Some folks are predisposed to that. Some folks are predisposed to heart disease. Some folks are predisposed to cancer. We're in a fallen world, okay? So we're all going to have to deal with something. Depression is one of the things. It's interesting, we get the same answer from science and from scripture. I mean, imagine that. The only verse in the Bible that I'm aware of that tells us anything about Jesus from the time he ditched his parents at the temple when he was 12 to the time he started his public ministry, what, around 30, is Luke 2:52. It's interesting to me that this verse is in the gospel that was written by a physician. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Four different ways he grew and developed: wisdom, mentally, psychologically; stature, physically, biologically; favor with God, spiritually; favor with men, relationally. Four different areas in which health, good things can happen, health can happen. Four different areas in which something untoward or some things untoward can happen, and unhealth, dysfunction, disorder can happen. So when we're looking at any particular presentation of depression, and there are many, we want to look at what are the potential contributors from each of those four areas. I think that's good theology. It's also good science. And even in the secular scientific world, we've got the biopsychosocial and some would add spiritual model for the development of mental disorders. So they agree. It's kind of neat.
Many folks are looking for help. We're needing help. We're going to go to a doc, as we appropriately should, and that doc is going to, in many cases, subscribe meds. Can you give us some ideas of when should you go on meds and when should you say no to meds, even if one doctor is saying you should do it?
So I want to be careful with that one, because the decision to medicate, that is a doctor's call, and that's above my pay grade. But the things that we want to consider, medication in depression is effective maybe 50% of the time. The best results are going to be a combination of things, resources from all four of those areas, particularly a combination of medication and psychotherapy or counseling. Should some people be on meds? Yeah, absolutely. If somebody's coming to me as a counselor wanting to work on depression and they absolutely don't even have the energy to engage in the therapy, we got to do some medication just to get them to the place where they can engage. But let me go back to those four areas and say, if medication is all we're doing, we're ignoring other biological resources, because meds aren't the only biological resource. We're ignoring resources from the psychological, the spiritual, the relational.
There's some in the faith world that would say, if you know Jesus, if you're operating by faith, this shouldn't be an issue. You got a faith issue. Come on. Just kind of suck it up, get your act together with God, and everything will be fine. What do you say to that?
I think we've shown that that's that's not even a biblical way to look at it. But look at Scripture. Some of the the best good guys throughout Scripture struggled with depression. Certainly King David, Naomi in the book of Ruth was depressed. You see her coming back into her people, and that's her whole presentation.
Elijah, sure. He goes and he has a major victory, and you think he'd be on top of the world, and all of a sudden he crashes and he retreats to a cave and is by himself.
Job, Jeremiah, my goodness. You look at the depressions throughout those.
Yeah, probably Moses when he escapes and he goes into Midian and he's by himself, yeah.
Yeah, well, and there's the relationship piece again, too. Yeah, sure.
Right. So if I'm feeling this way, I shouldn't start beating myself up that God has abandoned me or that I'm not good enough any more than I shouldn't beat myself up that God's not abandoning me, I'm not good enough if I've got my back issue.
Exactly. Same deal. One's in the mental and emotional world, one's in the skeletal world. People will do that. God must have forsaken me. God must be punishing me. We look at major depressive disorder. That's an illness. And it's an illness that's worth treating.
What should I do or the average friend or family member do for someone close to them who's in depression? Should we talk about it? Should we just try to cheer them up and be happy, happy, clapping them around them? Should we avoid it because they don't want to think about it? I mean, give us some tips.
Certainly we want to talk about it. We don't want to avoid it. It's not going to help it's going to help just as little to avoid it as it is to try to pull, come on, let's go cheer up. No, that's not going to help either. Very patient, caring, connection, empathy. Chuck Mingo preached a message on empathy not too long ago. Listening, careful listening, walking
along.
Walking alongside, supporting, encouraging the person to get some professional help with the depression. Maybe even go into that first appointment with them if they're open to that and if you're open to that.
Well, that's good, man. Thank you so much for spending time with us, pouring some of your wisdom into us. Very, very helpful as we all engage with this in one way, shape, or form.
Thank you. My privilege.
All right, brother.
That was great, right? Great foundation for this topic. You know, the thing about depression is it's a condition you can be born with in the same way that you can be born with a bad back. Or it's an event that can be brought on by a catastrophic event in your life. In the same way that you can have a car accident and that produces a bad back. Our next speaker is a guy named Michael Chitwood. He's a leader at World Vision, which is one of the world's largest humanitarian organizations. And you're going to hear his story of dealing with pain and depression in his family. Let's welcome Michael.
My brother David died 9 years ago alone in my mom's basement when he was just 37 years old. He died of alcoholism, obesity, and depression. But I believe the real cause of his death was the fact that there were not enough Jesus followers willing to authentically step into his pain and love him in a real way. And I include myself in that group of people. I want to talk to you a little bit about pain. I know it's not a fun subject, but I believe that how we respond to the pain of others is perhaps the single most important question we can answer if we want to follow Jesus. We are all hardwired to avoid pain at all costs. We avoid our own pain, and we avoid being around the pain of others. The ability to see the potential for pain in a given situation, to see a few steps down the road and adjust course accordingly, helps us to avoid pain if and when it can be avoided. But the reality is, pain is inevitable. It is unavoidable. Now, I actually made it through the first 25 years of my life pretty much pain-free. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is about as much in a bubble as you can get. I had two older brothers that were my heroes, Dan and Dave, two parents that loved me. I went to a great school, an awesome church, had a great group of friends. To be honest, for me as a kid, life was pretty easy. In my family, there were two career options. You could be a teacher or a preacher. So I decided to be a teacher. Right after school, I became a fifth grade teacher in Kankakee, Illinois, at a school very different than the one I grew up in. where about 98% of the kids came from low-income families. It was my first time personally witnessing poverty. It was after my second year as a teacher that I took my first trip to a developing country. My dad invited me to go to Haiti with him to train some teachers there. And I'll never forget the first two words I learned in Haitian Creole. Mwe grangu. Mwe grangu. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. Young kids would run alongside the cars we were in crying those words. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. Now, as a teacher, I'd seen poverty. The first homeless person I ever met in my life was a 10-year-old girl in the fifth grade class I taught. But I'd never seen anything like this. Kids with no safe water to drink, no food to eat, and often no shelter over their heads. It absolutely wrecked me. And so I came back from Haiti with an application to be a teacher there. But I was getting married the next summer, and all my friends and family told me that moving to Haiti as newlyweds was a bad idea because it wasn't safe. So despite a deep desire to do something to help those kids, I froze. I chickened out, and I let fear get the best of me. And instead, I took an incredible job doing youth ministry with Youth for Christ in Champaign, Illinois, working with high school students. But I knew deep in my spirit I had ignored a whisper from God to do something to help the poor. Well, it was during my first year of ministry and my first year of marriage that I had my first real personal experience with pain, and that bubble I grew up in was burst. My dad went in for what was supposed to be a routine rotator cuff surgery on his shoulder. Surgery went great, but something happened in post-op, and he slipped into a coma. And he died 3 days later on Mother's Day. It absolutely wrecked me. Here I was in my first year of marriage, 25 years old, first year of ministry, and I was struggling to even talk to God at all. Well, 2 years after losing my dad, almost to the day, I got a phone call that would change my life. It was one of my high school football buddies, Mark Smith. He was calling to tell me he was going to run the Chicago Marathon, and he wanted to know if I would drive up from Champaign, Illinois, to watch him run. Now, notice Mark did not ask me to run the marathon with him. Why would he? At the time, I weighed 265 pounds, and I couldn't run around the block if someone was chasing me. And I hated running. But when Mark told me he was running that marathon, I heard a whisper that I really believe was the Holy Spirit. It was just two words: do this. So despite the fact that I'd never even run a 5K and that I hated running, I signed up to run in the Chicago Marathon. At the time, to be honest, I didn't even know how far a marathon was. Just to be clear, it's 26.2 miles. Found that out the hard way, right? But over the next 6 months, I trained very, very slowly. I was so slow, my friends would say, "Hey, Chitwood, I thought you were training to run in that marathon." And I'd say, "I am training to run the marathon. Thanks so much for asking." And they'd say, "Oh, I keep seeing you walking all over town all the time." Well, I may have been slow, but something amazing happened out on those long, slow runs. I started talking to God again. To be honest, sometimes I was yelling at him. I was hurt and angry, and I figured he had it coming. Sometimes I'd pull over to the side of the road and just start weeping, and sometimes I was just listening to him. And then on October 15th, 2003, I towed the start line of my first race ever. I can so clearly remember walking to the starting line. A million people packed into the downtown streets of Chicago to watch this thing. Music blasting, all the traffic shut down, and 35,000 people towing that starting line ready to run 26.2 miles. We had just one problem. My buddy Mark and I had not discussed a race strategy. He had trained to run 9 minutes per mile in the race, and I had trained just to finish before they shut it down. So we decided we would try to split the difference somewhere in the middle. That was not a good idea for me. It did not go well. The wheels came off halfway through. I was in pain the entire time. That race was harder than I could have imagined. It destroyed me. But it changed my life physically, spiritually, and emotionally. And I decided that day I would do a race like the marathon every year for the rest of my life. So when I heard about the Ironman Triathlon, I knew I had to sign up. If you don't know what the Ironman is, it's a 2.4 mile open water swim. You get out of the water, you hop on a bike, you ride a bike for 112 miles, and then if you can still stand up, you lace up your shoes and you run 26.2 miles. When I signed up, I didn't own a bike and I didn't know how to swim. I never said I'm the smartest guy in a room. But I had seen what fear can do to you. Fear kept me from moving to Haiti. Fear almost made me quit training for my first marathon. In fact, I've come to believe that almost every amazing thing that God has for us in this life is on the other side of fear. And you have to step through fear to get to it. Well, one day I was on a 5-hour bike ride in the cornfields of central Illinois when I had what I can only describe as a conversation with God. And it went something like this. Hey, Michael, you could do these races and help those kids, kids like the ones you met in Haiti. And it was clear as day. I remembered seeing all these charities at these marathons I'd been doing, but I couldn't remember seeing any charities that were there raising money to help fight global poverty. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's what God was calling me to do, and not just for me to sign up for races and raise money, but that I would have the opportunity to invite thousands of other people to join me. And through the grace of God, I found myself on the doorsteps of World Vision, sharing this vision that God had given me. And 4 months later, after what I shared with them when I tried to pass off as a proposal for this new idea, they gave me a shot, and they hired me to be the first Team World Vision staff person 12 years ago this past January. That first year, we only had 100 runners run in the Chicago Marathon, but since then, we've helped 40,000 people cross finish lines, and we've raised over $40 million for clean water projects in Africa. You know, when I joined World Vision, I had no idea about the scope of World Vision's work. Let me check this out. World Vision is now the leading provider of clean water in the developing world. We are the leading implementing partner for the World Food Program, providing food to the needy. We, just last year, helped over 14 million people who were victims of disasters, refugees, or internally displaced people. And World Vision has the largest child sponsorship program in the world, with nearly 4 million kids being sponsored globally by donors here in the U.S. and globally. It is only by the grace of God that when I had this vision on that bike ride, that he brought me to the doorsteps of World Vision. Because over the past 12 years, I've had a front row seat to see God do some amazing things, both here in the lives of folks who are signing up to run marathons, and in the lives of the children and communities, as I've traveled 16 times to Africa to see World Vision's work. But I've had some more heartbreaks along the way. When my dad died, one of the toughest things I had to come to terms with, that I was only 25 years old the first time I experienced pain. I realized the longer I live, the more pain and heartache I have in store for me, that there's more to come. It was just 8 years after losing my dad that we lost my brother David. Now, David had already been battling alcoholism, obesity, and depression, but the loss of my dad beat him down and beat him down until he wound up spending most of his days alone in my mom's basement, where alcoholism, depression, and his battle with weight finally took his life. He was 37 years old when he died. He left behind a wife and 4 young kids. And then just as I was catching my breath and getting on my feet, my brother Dan died. No real explanation. He went upstairs to get ready for his daughter's 8th grade basketball game, and he never came down. Dan was a pastor. He was 45 years old. He also had a wife he left without her husband and 4 young kids he left without their dad. Now, as if losing my dad wasn't enough, losing 2 of her 3 sons absolutely broke my mom's heart, and it literally crushed my spirit. You know, there have been times when I'm not sure I'd be able to get out of bed. Times when a song comes on the radio and it's just crushing, and I fall apart sobbing uncontrollably. And sometimes people will say to me, Michael, it's so great that you've been able to take the pain in your life and turn it into something positive for others. Like they think I'm through it. Like I'm over the pain and heartache and grief. That I don't get depressed anymore. I'd be lying if I said I'm not hurt anymore. I am. Or that I don't get angry at God or feel hopeless. I do. But I do my best to not get stuck in that hurt, that anger, that hopelessness. A few months after Dan died, I came across a Bible verse that completely rocked my worldview. It's Psalm 34:18, and it's just one sentence. I hope you'll memorize it. It says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and he rescues those whose spirits are crushed." You know, I've learned the hard way that this life has more pain and heartache for me than I ever imagined. But here's the deal with pain. Either you've already experienced this type of pain and you know exactly what I'm talking about. Or maybe You are in the midst of a painful experience right now, or at some point you will be headed into one. Pain is inevitable. Now, maybe your pain wasn't the death of a loved one. Maybe it was a divorce in your family, a lost job, a struggle with infertility, depression, or addiction. But you faced this pain, and like me, you've been hurt and frustrated with God when things went terribly wrong. But God does not tell us we're exempt from pain. Look at our heroes in the Bible. They did not live lives of ease and comfort, but their spiritual journeys were formed through times of pain and heartache and suffering, and so are yours and mine. It is a fact that this life holds more pain for you than you can ever imagine, and you will often find it unbearable. And if you haven't felt it yet, it's only fair to warn you, it will come. So what does Psalm 34:18 have to say to me when I'm facing pain? It says, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and he rescues those whose spirits are crushed. It says, when I am brokenhearted, the Lord is close to me, even when it doesn't feel like he is. And when my spirit has been crushed, he can rescue me. But you know, it's so easy to get caught up in your own pain. It's easy to forget that there are other hurting people in the world. When I was a kid, if I wasn't getting my way, I'd say to my parents, that's just not fair. And my parents would reply, well, Michael, guess what? Life's just not fair. And they were joking, but there's a lot of truth in that statement, isn't there? Life isn't fair. Well, after losing my dad, I would say to myself so often, God, this isn't fair. And one day, I was standing in my mom's kitchen at her home, and I said it out loud to her. And my mom gently reminded me of others in this world who have truly experienced the unfairness of this life. She reminded me that there are kids that are going to die today because they don't have enough food to eat or safe water to drink. She reminded me of the millions of people, refugees, who are fleeing their homes in search of a safe place to go. And guess what? They're not going to find one. She reminded me that there are more people trapped in slavery today than at any point in human history. There are kids being forced to fight as child soldiers in wars, and there are 10 and 11-year-old girls being forced into marriages with grown men. And then I began to think of my World Vision sponsored child, Maureen, who lives in rural Kenya. Maureen was just 3 years old the first time I met her. In her community, there was no access to safe water. The school she went to was a wooden shack. Half the kids died before their fifth birthday. And there was no health care at all. Maureen has fears and worries and pain, the likes of which I will never have to know. Sure, I've faced more pain and heartache in this world than I ever imagined possible, but I've also seen our fellow man living in conditions that are unspeakable. It's easy to get focused on my own pain. I can forget that there are other hurting people in this world. What does Psalm 34:18 have to say to them? The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and he rescues those whose spirits are crushed. It says that when others are brokenhearted, the Lord is close to them, even when it doesn't feel like he is. And when their spirits are crushed, he can rescue them. A couple of years before my dad died, my brother Dan gave him a journal called A Father's Legacy. And on one of the last pages, my dad answered this epic question: what is the spiritual legacy you'd like to leave for others? Here's his response, written on his way home from an amputee camp in Sierra Leone, Africa, where they were fitting people who were victims of the Civil War, amputees, with prosthetic limbs made out of old truck tires and pipes. He said, several pages in this book were written on my Sierra Leone trip. This is my last one on the way home. As I sit here in a first-class seat and think back of the people on the streets of Freetown, the poverty now that I've seen in Haiti, Nicaragua, and Freetown has forever changed my life. The absolute luxury we enjoy in America is hard to enjoy once you've seen our fellow man living in poverty, not knowing if they will have a next meal or when they'll have a meal. What spiritual legacy do I want to leave? Only that we will remember the poor and do what we can to relieve their suffering. Folks, there is often very little we can do about our own pain. But there is always something we can do to relieve the pain of others. It's tough, though. It's hard to be around hurting people. Walking with a friend whose 3-year-old daughter was just diagnosed with cancer and not knowing what to say or how to help, or sitting with your brother who's battling addiction, watching him hurt his family as he breaks promise after promise to change, or building a relationship with a woman who's homeless and entering into her pain and understanding the painful story that brought her in life to the point where she is. It's hard to be around hurting people. It's so much easier to spend time with people who aren't going through the toughest experiences of their lives. It's easier to keep our distance. And it can be overwhelming to think about tackling massive issues like racial injustice, mass incarceration, the global water crisis, or human trafficking. But we cannot follow Jesus and remain in our bubble, ignoring the pain of others. And here's the amazing thing about it. When you meet people in those broken places, whether it's the woman at a homeless shelter or a child like Maureen living in rural Kenya, you are not simply being Jesus to them. You are meeting Jesus in them. My brother David died in a basement feeling hopeless and alone. And I often wonder how his life might have been different if there had been more Jesus followers willing to enter in his pain and show him the relentless love of Jesus, if I had been willing to go there with him more often. Right now, you have friends and colleagues, family members and neighbors who are going through things you can't even wrap your heads around. They are hurting terribly. And we have brothers and sisters around the world who are facing pain we can't even imagine. And our tendency is to protect our own comfort, safety, and privilege, to keep our distance from the pain and hurt of others and that which exists in the world. But God is calling us to break free from the trap of individualism and self-preservation and to step into the pain of others. Now, from a practical standpoint, you may be wondering, you may see someone hurting, and you just don't know what to do. I'll tell you this, you don't have to get it right every time. But you got to do something. You got to show up. Don't put it off. Make the phone call. Bring that meal. Sign up to mentor or tutor that kid. If you've got a friend battling grief or depression or addiction, show up and tell them you love them and show them you love them even more, because guess what? Hurting people aren't going to tell you how they need you to step into their pain. There's no simple instruction manual. You just need to start stepping into it. It is the only chance we have to change the world. And here's the amazing thing about it. How you respond to the pain of others may change just one life. Or God may give you a vision that helps change millions of lives around the world. But the reality is, if you will intentionally step into the pain of others, it will certainly change your life. Friends, if you're here today and you're hurting, and you're going through the most painful thing you could ever imagine, I want to tell you that God is near you and he can rescue you. And I want to remind all of us here that God is calling us, each and every one of us, to intentionally step into the pain of others and show them the overwhelming, never-ending, life-changing, reckless love of Jesus Christ. Thanks so much.
Now, we're going to be blessed right now. We're going to hear from an amazing, amazing woman in our community. I want you to pay attention and welcome Leslie.
I'm smart. I'm strong. I'm relational. I'm smart enough to know better. I'm strong enough to do this on my own. I'm relational and flirtatious. I was only asking for it. My name's Leslie, and I grew up on the border of Mexico in a small town called Yuma, Arizona. I had a pretty average upbringing. I was a mathlete, and if you've never heard of mathletes, it's kind of like a regular athlete, but you do algebra and geometry and that kind of stuff. So I did that, and I stayed out of trouble, and I had a pretty average home life, pretty good home life, good family. When I graduated high school, I moved to L.A., and I pursued school out there. And while I was out there, I fell in love with live production, so much so that I ended up chasing that passion and doing set and lighting design for a company that did 80 live shows a year across the country. So that was awesome. And I got to travel with people, another team of people that became my family that we got to do these live shows with. It was a dream. One summer, in between my two tour seasons, I decided to go to a party with some of my tour friends. I went with my friends Crystal and James. We showed up to this pretty chill party. There was a bonfire out back and some drinks inside. And so as I was waiting for some of my other friends, JC and Nick, to show up, we went inside and Crystal and I grabbed a drink. And then I had another. And then I didn't remember anything else. And what was most likely hours later, I came to in a room I didn't fully recognize, without any recollection of how I'd gotten there. And I was being sexually assaulted by my so-called friend, Nick. Little did I know in that moment that I had woken up as a statistic, that 1 in 10 women are raped or sexually assaulted after being drugged. I had woken up in a nightmare. Nick and I struggled back and forth for a while. Eventually, he gave up and left. And exhausted, I went to sleep. The next morning, still in a fog, I got up, got dressed, and I went to work. I couldn't imagine that a friend, that someone I considered family, would do something like that to me. So I just pretended like it didn't happen. But as the bruises began to heal, the truth started to leak out, or at least versions of the truth. And I was confronted by the company that I worked for about the events that night. And in an effort to save my job, to jump out in front of that moving train, I agreed to apologize for my behavior. See, when you're in the midst of suffering, it is so easy to cling to any lie that will help you stop drowning. And I was drowning in fear and doubt and so much pain. I needed something to stop me from sinking. So that's the first lie that I clung to, that being assaulted was somehow my fault. And let me just time out here for a second. If that has ever happened to you, if you've ever been raped or assaulted, it is not your fault. Regardless of what you think your reputation was beforehand, regardless of what you were wearing, regardless of what anybody says, it is not your fault. For me, in that moment, that's the only thing I could believe. Things kind of settled from there, and I tried to get back to my normal life, and the company asked that I not talk to anybody else about what had happened. But I was angry. I was angry at my friends who were supposed to protect me in that moment, who let me go home with Nick. I doubted God that he had anything good for me after this. And I was so utterly alone. I was drowning. But get back to normal life is what people wanted for me. So that's what I tried to do. And it seemed for the most part like I was succeeding. I finished my second year of tour. I moved home to be with my family after my mom suffered a massive stroke. I got married. I moved across the country. I started a new job. Struggled through the first year of marriage, and then the second, and then the third. I started a different job, and finally, as everything kind of settled and all the change was done, I took a deep breath and realized that I still felt horrible. I was back into regular rhythms, but I was far from feeling normal. I was experiencing deep sadness and crying all the time. I couldn't sleep at night, but I was up and exhausted all day long. I had shallow relationships. I was pulling away from friends and family because I couldn't be honest with where I was at. I had trouble stringing simple thoughts together. Just putting sentences together was difficult. And it wasn't until I was sitting with a friend that I mentored and she was talking about her symptoms of depression, that I realized I was still clinging to those lies that were dragging me down. I had moved so quickly to wanting to be normal that I'd settled in this place called functioning, and I was barely treading water. I was exhausted. I was tired of drowning, and I was tired of settling for broken. I had to start fighting those lies. That looked like getting brutally honest with my husband, telling him exactly what I was feeling and why. I enlisted leaders in my life that I could trust, that I knew that wouldn't judge me when I said I was dealing with something. I started to go to counseling because I needed someone on the outside that could speak into this conversation, this internal dialogue that I've been having with myself. And then I had to start acknowledging those lies. Lies like, I'm smart enough to know better. I'm strong enough to do this on my own. I'm relational and flirtatious. I was only asking for it. Or lies maybe that you can relate to, like emotional mess, victim, inconvenience. No one is interested in my struggle. Not good enough, not enough faith. Or lies like, you're only damaged goods. You will never be whole again. One of the biggest ways that I combat those lies is through music. These days, it's hard for me to find the words to describe how I'm feeling, and I can't put my emotions into eloquent phrases. But I needed something, a pathway for my emotions, a way to express and release those things. And music does that. When I can't find the words, I just use someone else's. It helps point me to reality and to truth. And in a sense, that's what worship is. It's calling out truths about God, and it's a weapon we can use to fight back against these lies. So we can't control our genetics. We can't control some of the things that happen to us, but we can adjust our response. So for me, when I am feeling the most broken, I turn to God, and as best as I can, I just start handing over the pieces. I get down on my knees, I turn the music up loud, and I just start naming the things that are overwhelming me, naming the lies. And this is really important because lies are like shadows. They can seem like reality. They can look like the truth. And they can be scary. But when you step back and shine a big old light in that corner, sometimes when you find out what the truth is, those lies can feel a little silly. So I have to shift from naming those lies to then praising God for all the ways He is good, even when I don't believe it. Even when it's hard to understand, and even when I don't see it, even when I have zero things to be thankful for that don't feel trivial or forced, I make that shift. And I just agree with what the song's saying when I can't put it into my own words. That's the first step I take. Psalm 69 says this, I'm hurt and in pain. Give me space for healing and mountain air. Let me shout God's name with a praising song. Let me tell His greatness in a prayer of thanks. For God, this is better than oxen on the altar, far better than blue ribbon bulls. Take the poor in spirit, see and are glad. Oh, you God seekers, take heart. Far better than anything I could offer God is my sacrifice of my pain for His praise. Because when we take our eyes off our own pain and turn to a God that can actually do something about it, that's when things begin to shift. That's where lies begin to fall away and we can find true hope. And that's where real healing can happen. Depression sucks. And I can't say that I'm operating at 100% all the time. But hour by hour and day by day, I'm finding more and more hope. And I have people in my life that can point me to shallow waters when I feel like I'm drowning. I am strong. I am smart. And I am relational. I don't have to settle for broken, and neither do you. We are worth the fight. And God is willing to fight for us if we just let him. Thank you.